It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Cities and towns all over the United States were shaped by a system that many of us have never even heard of. It's called redlining, a discriminatory practice by which banks and other financial institutions refuse to serve specific neighborhoods, usually based on race. The system was put into place following the Great Depression, but the patterns of redlining predate that time, and some of those discriminatory practices endure. This hour, we'll find out about redlining in Iowa and around the country, and the new Undesign the Red Line exhibit in Des Moines. The Polk County Housing Trust has been working with the national group Designing the We to create and localize this exhibit. And Ramona Bates, who lives in Des Moines, is a member of the advisory board for the project. She's also the head of the King Irving Neighborhood Association, and she's with me on the line. Hello, Ramona.
Hello, how are you?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for talking with me. And before you got involved in this project, redlining was not a term that you were familiar with. What was it like for you when you learned what redlining was?
Well, it was actually, for me, kind of shocking to understand what redlining was and how it affects the different communities in our different neighborhoods in our community.
Yeah, when you learned what it was, I understand you kind of had an aha moment because now you had a term to put to something that you'd seen, right?
Absolutely. And growing up, you know, I just remember going through different things, and I did not understand it was because of redlining. So the neighborhood that I live in currently is the King Irving neighborhood. And that's in Des Moines. And when I was a little girl, the neighborhood was vibrant. It had businesses. It had grocery stores. It had theaters. It had laundromats and dry cleaners. And it was just a vibrant neighborhood. And then I moved out of the neighborhood and then returned back to this neighborhood. And there's hardly anything here. We have one store, which is a really nice store. It caters to a variety of people, but, you know, we don't have a lot of stores that, if I went out to West Des Moines, you know, they got grocery store around the corner, Walmart, Sam's, you know, dollar store. I mean, all kinds of things.
So although redlining as it's focused on in the exhibit, I mean, this practice was very specific and put into place after the Great Depression, but you really feel like you're seeing those continued practices and the fallout that they've had on your streets, in your neighborhood.
Yes, I do. there's still, I think, things going on, such as there's a park close to our neighborhood by the Grub Y, and they tore down the shelter. They, meaning the city of Des Moines and Parks and Recs, tore down the shelter because it said it was in disrepair, but they didn't put another shelter up, and they're talking about it's going to take quite a few years or months or to decide what they're going to do and if they're going to put it up. So as I talked to my Caucasian friends and ask them, like, if they live in Grimes, you know, if that happens in their community, do you think that would happen? And they're like, no, we wouldn't stand for that. And they would just, the city would, if they tore it down, they would put it back up. Simple as that. But that's not happening in our community.
Now, of course, the official policy of redlining, it's not something, at least historically speaking, when you and I were growing up, it wasn't something that was taught about in schools. It was a part of our government policy, our history, that really nobody was ever meant to learn about. Now that you know about it, how does that change how you feel?
Well, it just gives me a different perspective on what's going on in my community and how I can help educate people to the effects of redlining and what we can do, as the one exhibit says, to redesign the red line. And so that's what I want to do, is just help to educate people about redlining and how it affects different neighborhoods, different communities, and what we could do to make those communities or neighborhoods vital again.
With this exhibit, it's an interactive exhibit, and although it comes from a national exhibit, it has been localized to really uncover the history of Des Moines. So a lot of stories that haven't been told are coming to light here. What do you want people to take away when they visit the exhibit?
I want them to just to take away, like for me, the aha. I had talked to one of my coworkers at Big Head Start, and we had a professional development surrounding the redlining, and so some of my coworkers were able to see the exhibit, and a lot of them came back and said thank you because they had no idea about the effects of redlining and how it affects still people to this day. And so, you know, just even when the interstate came in and I-235 and how it just demolished the whole Black community, a vibrant Black community, and understanding why that happened and how that happened and to make sure that that doesn't happen again.
Ramona Bates, thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome.
Ramona Bates of Des Moines, she is the head of the King Irving Neighborhood Association and on the advisory board for the Undesign the Red Line exhibit, now on display at Franklin Junior High in Des Moines, with guided tours scheduled four times a week through April 18th. The exhibit was put together through a partnership between a social impact firm called Designing the We and locally by the Polk County Housing Trust Fund. And with me now is Braden Crooks, co-founder of Designing the We. Hello, Braden.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And we were just listening to Ramona Bates talk about some of the ways she sees the legacy of redlining in her neighborhood in Des Moines today. And redlining was a very specific government policy from the Federal Housing Administration. It started in the 1930s. Give us some background. Tell me about what this policy was and why it started.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you point out, right, this is coming about in conjunction with the New Deal. And the federal government is responding to the Great Depression. We're creating middle-class wealth-building programs. But, okay, it's the 1930s, and the federal government really is explicitly racist institution, and Jim Crow is alive and well. And they're going to want to bake into a lot of these programs and policies ways to cut out people of color from benefiting from them. And this happens in many, many different ways. And redlining is how we do this with home ownership. So the federal government, in the wake of the Great Depression, there's also a foreclosure crisis in that era, and they want to step into the private housing market and prop that up. And they invent the 30-year mortgage and 15-year mortgage. They're going to be federally insuring home buyers. You know, we eventually get zero money down home loans and GI Bill. And so we really create the American dream of owning your own home as a core piece of middle-class identity with these policies. Beforehand, you know, you might have to put half or even all down, maybe get a five-year mortgage. So this is going to open up home ownership, but they really want to make sure that opportunity is reserved for white families. And redlining is part of how that happens. And essentially, they start giving out these loans and realize, wait a minute, we don't have one ubiquitous national system for evaluating creditworthiness and risk. And this is before you and I would have a credit score. And so with redlining, they decide, why don't we give everybody's neighborhood a credit score? So rather than you and I having a credit score, your neighborhood would. And so this creates these zones. And depending on, you know, different factors, they're going to give us one of four ratings. There's only four. You either get green, which is great, definitely lend here. Blue, which is the next step down, pretty good. Yellow, which is sometimes considered declining, and finally red, which is called hazardous areas, which is where the term redlining comes from. And this is a national system, and they map out 239 American cities and color code them in this way to say, here's a neighborhood where we want to see credit flow, and here's a neighborhood where really this is going to dry up. And because it's, one, it's backed by the federal government, it's a huge national system, and two, because it's feeding into a lot of things that are already going on and, you know, patterns that are developing, redlining becomes incredibly impactful, not only for these federally backed home loans, but also other types of credit. So business loans, bank branch locations, insurance rates, access to the money system in general is often going to be kind of cut off and strangled in these neighborhoods. And as Ramona was saying, right, when this is first initiated, these areas that are red are not blighted, abandoned, empty places. They are actually very vibrant. These are storefronts are full of people, you know, and they're often mixed income neighborhoods and areas with dense housing and things like that. But the federal government nonetheless is going to say, here's an area where we're going to disinvest. And they send these neighborhoods on a pathway of disinvestment. So over time, property values decline. It's harder to start a business. It's harder to sell your home, you name it, right? So these areas enter a cycle of decline and disinvestment that continues even well after redlining is formally made illegal.
Which wasn't until 1968, right?
Well, redlining coming from the federal government is made illegal before that, but you're right, the 68 Fair Housing Act is really the first, perhaps the only major intervention the government takes into racial discrimination in housing. And a lot of the practices that are going on, if not coming from the federal government, but certainly coming from private industry and the real estate industry, are formally made illegal in 68. That being said, the practices in many cases continue today. The Fair Housing Act wasn't enforced for quite a long time, and even today there's issues around enforcement. So,
right, we've heard about lawsuits taking place in just the last year based on this kind of discrimination still being carried out.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so the question is, well, why zone these areas red, right? Why give them this hazardous rating?
And let's talk about that after we take a short break. With me is Braden Crooks. He's co-founder of the social impact firm Designing the We. And Designing the We has created this exhibit about redlining and how it has shaped our cities and towns across the nation to travel around the country and be localized for the town that it visits. It's in Des Moines right now. It has been locally put together by the Polk County Housing Trust Fund, and we'll find out a lot more about redlining in Des Moines in just a moment. The exhibit is called Undesign the Red Line. It's on display at Franklin Junior High in Des Moines. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the policy of redlining and how it shapes cities and towns all over the country and in Iowa. Undesign the Red Line is an exhibit that explores the history and legacy of redlining in Des Moines. It's on display at Franklin Junior High in Des Moines with guided tours scheduled four times a week through April 18th. The exhibit was put together through a partnership between a social impact firm called Designing the We and locally by the Polk County Housing Trust Fund. With me right now is Braden Crooks, co-founder of Designing the We. And before we bring another guest in the conversation, Braden, I had to cut you off just before the break when you were just about... You were describing the federal policy of redlining that was created by the Federal Housing Administration in the 1930s, where there were neighborhoods in cities all over the country, 239 cities that were designated as red. That meant that banks should not invest. They shouldn't loan to people who wanted to buy homes or start businesses in those parts of these cities. And you were just about to tell us why those parts of the cities were considered to be red or no-go areas.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I was saying, right, this is going to send these neighborhoods on a very different trajectory of disinvestment. And the key question is, well, why do that to a neighborhood, right? And they give many reasons, but if you look in these maps, and this is coming from federal language, you'll see things like this, hazardous influences or detrimental influences, Negro infiltration. That's federal language. The federal government comes out and says, there are hazardous racial and social groups in America, and we need to know where they are and where they're quote unquote infiltrating, or the FHA's language, invading. And what they're going to do is begin zoning these areas as areas of disinvestment. And what it does is this is going to accelerate and deepen a process of concentrating people into red line neighborhoods at the same time that we're disinvesting and devaluing these neighborhoods. So we create hypersegregation and segregated geography, which is an ongoing pattern, but this is going to accelerate it. And then also we create disinvestment in these neighborhoods. So families who were building wealth, those small business owners we were talking about, Other folks, are going to lose that. Instead of, if you are happen to be a homeowner, for example, in a red line neighborhood, you think you bought into the American dream. Well, actually, you bought in an area that's slated for disinvestment. So you're going to, this is, doesn't become the asset you send your kids to college with, You go underwater and lose your money. And this happened to millions of families across the country. And it helped create this racialized geography, and it helped create a massive racial wealth gap in the United States. And these two structural pieces of redlining and its connected policies are still with us today.
You designed your first exhibit about redlining 4 or 5 years ago and displayed it in the Bronx. But you designed these exhibits with the idea that they would travel around the country and that local communities could also share their own history?
Yes. So as Ramona was pointing out, she's part of our kind of community advisory group. And we bring people with our hosts, like Polk County Housing Trust Fund, together around this topic to say, what are the stories that we need to tell locally? What do we need to hear and lift up about Des Moines and Des Moines' history? Des Moines has a very deep history of this. Des Moines was, many neighborhoods were redlined. There was segregation. There was policies like slum clearance and urban renewal, which destroyed Central Avenue, for example, in Des Moines, which was a thriving corridor of Black businesses. And destroyed wealth. And this was all done very deliberately by our, you know, all levels, local, state, and federal.
Well, this is the perfect time to bring Kendall Larson into the conversation. She's the director of research and planning at the Polk County Housing Trust. She also did her master's thesis on redlining in Des Moines, so has a deep, deep knowledge of this history. Hello, Kendall.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today. And, you know, talking to Braden about the federal policy of redlining, when you decided to bring this exhibit to Iowa, you had already done a great deal of research on redlining, but this project has been huge to really dig deep into the history of redlining in Des Moines. Tell me more about how you went about that.
Yeah, so we had had the exhibit here last April, actually, as part of our Affordable Housing Week. We had heard about Braden and Designing the We and thought it would be interesting to bring kind of that general exhibit here to Des Moines to see what people thought about it. And when it was here, it got a great reception. And so we decided, let's talk with Braden more and Designing the We and think about, you know, now that it's had a really good reception and people are interested in learning more about how this actually affected Des Moines, that we would bring it back and do the research and take a lot of what I had researched in my master's thesis as well and put it together and really go out and get stories from individuals about their experiences through not just redlining, but also the impact of urban renewal and the impact of other issues that are continuing today and other discriminatory practices that continue to happen in Des Moines.
Now, we do know that there was a redlining map also created for Waterloo in Iowa, and clearly that shaped that community in many ways as well. But we are focusing on Des Moines today. However, if you'd like to join our conversation, if you have memories of redlining or knowledge that you'd like to share about how you've seen this legacy in action here in Iowa, you can give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Kendall, in reaching out to individuals who have a stake in Des Moines neighborhoods, but also may have had experience with redlining in Iowa, was that difficult to find people who actually knew about the practice or would respond to those questions?
Yeah, so initially it was people didn't know what that term really meant. And we had our first meeting with our community advisory group. We had Braden there to help us let them know what we were doing and what this actually meant and give them an understanding of what redlining really is and how it's impacted their communities. And so initially it was a little hard to get those people to answer questions about, were you affected by redlining? And a lot of people said, well, I don't really know because I don't know what redlining is. And so initially it was, but the more and more we talked to individuals and, you know, really heard from them about the experiences of discrimination, and a lot of people mostly talked about their experiences of urban renewal in the 1960s and 70s as they were small children and experienced this as they grew up. But the more and more we talked to them, the more and more they talked to their friends and families, not just in Des Moines, but people who once lived in Des Moines and have moved other places. So we were able to get people who had lived here and experienced different parts of the history, of this history, across generations.
When people visit the exhibit, I know that this is an interactive exhibit. Tell me, I know also that there's a lot more in the exhibit than we can really talk about in the next half hour or so.
Right.
But when people visit, I mean, I assume that one of the first things that they're faced with is a map that shows them Des Moines. What can you learn from looking at that map?
Yeah, so when looking at the Des Moines map, which was created in 1938, we have it large enough so that you can get up really close and you can read the streets and you can really see the colors and where the boundaries are of the redlined communities. And so, you know, when you walk in, we always suggest everybody walking up there and interacting with that map. And we do, along with what the designing the Wii created for the interaction with this map, is placing different pins on either where you once lived, if you used to live in the city of Des Moines, or if you currently live in the city of Des Moines, to find where your house is and to put a pin in there and really look around where your pin is and think about, oh, that's interesting. You know, maybe I live in an A neighborhood. How does my community look today? Or maybe I live, used to live in this part of a D neighborhood or a bad neighborhood, and think about how the community has changed and think about the history of what your house has been through and the community that has been around it. So it's been really interesting to watch people interact with the map and think about, oh my gosh, I had no idea. My family lived here and, you know, they experienced a lot of discrimination over the years and, you know, oh, now I can visually see that this is where they were and this might have been a cause of why that happened to them. So it's been really, really interesting for people to interact with the map once they walk through it and really take a look.
Well, and Braden, you mentioned Central Avenue in Des Moines, which, as you mentioned, also was a thriving neighborhood, and it just isn't there anymore. So, Braden, when people come to exhibits like this one and look at a map, I mean, they can see not just the legacy, but in some cases, wholesale destruction of these redlined neighborhoods, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's because a lot of these policies layer on top of each other, right? Once an area was redlined and property values began to decline and so forth, these are often, you know, 5-10 years later, areas that get picked as quote-unquote slums during urban renewal that need to be knocked down. And you see these types of boundaries live on for decades afterward in sometimes school districts, sometimes policing, all sorts of different kind of boundaries. And, you know, we were working with Dr. Lawrence Brown in Baltimore, for example, who mapped zip car locations to redlining maps. And that's not because zip car looks at these maps, but some of the same patterns of where, you know, folks that might have money to spend on zip car are the same as they were even back in 1938, because these boundaries are become so embedded in the landscape.
And Kendall, when people in Des Moines come to the exhibit and they look at the map, do you have an opportunity where they can see what the map, or, you know, what that map represented when it was created in the 1930s and what's there now?
Yeah, so there are descriptions that talk about each section of the map. There's letters and numbers that correlate to a description, a little paragraph that really describes why this neighborhood was given this number and color. And so people can really dive in and understand that, oh, there was a large population of people of color, and that's why it is red, or it had a large laboring class, service workforce, low income. That's why it is. Similarly, there's one section that was predominantly Italian, which at that point in time was a hazardous influence or a hazardous group, as the federal government said. And so it's interesting for them to really dive in and read those descriptions to understand why those neighborhoods were the way they were
and
described.
This is not just an exhibit that, that people wander through. You have guided tours 4 times a week
right.
that people can sign up for. Why do you think that's so important to have a guided tour through the exhibit?
The history and kind of this context and this idea of redlining and this system, because it's not talked about in history classes, you know, in high schools or, you know, even in college, it's not really talked about. It's something that a lot of people are not knowledgeable. And so if you were to go through the exhibit by yourself, there's so much information that you can take from it. But if you don't really know where to start and really have a good understanding or have it explained to you what this actually, this system of redlining actually means and how it impacts today, then it's a lot of information to just try to read in yourself and not have explained to you. So that's why it's really important to have a guided tour, because then it leads you through the different decades of how, from the 1930s when redlining was put into effect, and then, you know, into the 1960s when urban renewal and slum clearance happened, and into the 70s, 80s, 90s, and today, where all of these different policies have been put into place by the federal government, are still cycling the same way that it has for a really long time, and allowing these different discriminatory practices, especially in housing, to last for decades.
Well, and deeply impact families today. And Kendall, you're going to stay with us. Braden, we're going to let you go in just a few minutes. But before you go, that is so essential for people to understand the legacy of redlining and how it still impacts people today. What is the main takeaway that you want people to have about that?
Well, you know, I really think we at Designing the We, myself and co-founder of Designing the We, April B. Simone, who grew up in the Bronx and experienced that redlining herself, you know, we really feel like we can't really know where we're going before we ask the question, how did we get here? And we really don't have a strong understanding, particularly in cities, of what happened. How did we get here? Why are we at the situation where we are today? And when folks don't know that, for example, they might look around a neighborhood and say, wow, why is this neighborhood dilapidated? Why is there abandoned houses here? Why, you know, are maybe people here are lazy and that's what's the problem? And without knowing that history, actually, this was a deliberate move by the federal government and all different types of stakeholders, private, real estate as well, and others. We come up with very different solutions as to what needs to come next. And so that's kind of the intention of the exhibit, is to look at this history, but also as an organizing tool to say, what do we need to do next? What does it mean to undesign this and undo it? We often say this is how structural racism really was designed into cities and places, and it's never been undone. So what are we going to do to undo it? And we often find that when we come up with policy decisions or projects or, you know, new development, et cetera, if we're not deliberately undoing this whole history, we're most often recreating it and reproducing it, even if that is unintentionally. So that's why we think that this type of exhibit, which is interactive and people are sharing their own stories and adding to it, but also asking collectively, okay, so what comes next and what are we going to do?
Braden Crooks, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Braden Crooks is co-founder of Designing the We. Again, this is the national organization, a social impact firm behind the Undesign the Red Line exhibit that's traveling the country. It's been localized for Des Moines through a partnership with the Polk County Housing Trust Fund. And we have just a minute before we go to break, Kendall, but are you finding that a lot of people are really surprised to learn that redlining even existed in Des Moines?
Yes. A lot of people, you know, think that, oh, this system only existed in the Washington, D.C.s or the San Franciscos or the Chicagos of the world, not little Des Moines in 1930, which had still a very small population at that time. And so people are very shocked coming in because they don't think it happened there. And, you know, it's a topic that a lot of people don't want to talk about. It's hard to talk about race and how it impacts our society, and how we think about what we're going to do moving on into the future. And so people have been shocked, but by the end, that shock kind of wears off and they, you know, think about, okay, how do we move forward now?
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Kendall Larson is Director of Research and Planning at Polk County Housing Trust. We're talking about the Undesign the Red Line exhibit. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the policy of redlining and how it shapes cities and towns all over the country and also here in Iowa. The exhibit Undesign the Red Line explores the history and legacy of redlining in Des Moines. It is on display at Franklin Junior High in Des Moines with guided tours scheduled four times a week through April 18th. The exhibit was put together through a partnership between a social impact firm called Designing the We and locally by the Polk County Housing Trust Fund. Kendall Larson is still with us, Director of Research and Planning at the Polk County Housing Trust. She also did her master's thesis on redlining in Des Moines. And I want to bring somebody else into the conversation now. Bobretta Bruton is a member of the Community Advisory Board for the exhibit, also a VISTA volunteer for Neighborhood or NeighborWorks, and she has seen the impact of redlining in Des Moines firsthand. Hello, Bobretta.
Good morning.
Oh, thank you so much for being here today. And you were born and raised along 2nd Avenue in Des Moines. You were born in 1948, and this was a neighborhood that had been redlined, right?
That's correct, yes.
And tell me about your neighborhood when you were growing up. What do you remember?
Well, we were all really good neighbors, and my grandmother had worked very hard to become a homeowner, and she owned her home, and she also opened up her home for her son, which would have been my father and his children. But then all of a sudden, there was this conversation about the destruction of the neighborhood, and the city was going to take her house. So I remember 5-6 years of that conversation and that actually happening. She was on 3rd Street, right around where Mercy Hospital is now. And then they relocated her to 8th Street, and the house was not the quality of the house that we were in on 3rd Street.
Well, and even when you were growing up in the 1950s, it was a diverse neighborhood, but there was real poverty around you. There were even times when you had to go down to the river to get water for your house?
Oh, yeah, because we were all part of the working poor. But the interesting thing is my father and my mother always said, well, we're poor, but we don't have to think poor. So they made sure that we had the basic needs, and that would include water. And if it was shut off, then we had to walk down to the riverbank. And there was a clear water trough, and then there was the trough that the horses dealt with. Mm. But anyway, we would have to get the water out of the trough and carry it back up to the hill. So as I remember it, it was like a walk between the post office and then coming back up the hill towards where Mercy is now.
Now, although, as we talked about earlier, redlining was made illegal in 1968 by the Fair Housing Act, we know that the legacy is strong. And you ran into some unfair housing practices when you wanted to move. In 1978, you tried to rent a duplex in Beaverdale. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, I made the phone call about the duplex, because I was trying to get my daughter into American Child Academy, and she was 4 years old, and so I wanted to live in that neighborhood close to the academy. So I called and asked, and the owner said, oh, yeah, that's a really good academy. Come on out and let's get you signed up. And when I got there, he looked at me, and he saw my color, and he told me that it had been rented already. Hmm. I said, well, I just talked to you about 5 minutes ago. Yeah, but I rented it. So anyway, I went to the human rights office and reported it. And then that evening I got a call, and they had sent some young people that appeared to be like college students, and they wanted to rent the duplex to have parties, and they thought it would be a great place to have parties, and he rented it to them.
Wow.
They were white.
Wow.
Yeah. So then the officer at the Human Rights Commission called me and said, so what do you want to do? Do you want to just sue and get a settlement, or do you want to go into the house and be close to where your daughter can go to preschool? And obviously I chose the preschool. So
although you had to rent from that man.
I had to rent from that man, but the priority was her getting off to a really good start in one of the best preschools in the city. So I could deal with that, and I did. She's now a supervisor for one of the airlines, so.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So in sharing your stories, but also in helping to tell the stories of redlining in Des Moines and being a part of creating this exhibit, what do you want to happen because of this? What do you want people to know and think about once they visit?
Well, first of all, I'm really grateful to Eric and the Polk County Housing Trust Fund. I mean, they've always done really reliable, accountable work. So when he called me and told me about this project, I was just thrilled and said, you know, anything that I can do, I would be more than willing to help. And since I was a VISTA with through NeighborWorks and the Neighborhood Finance Organization, it was like really a hand-in-glove fit. And our executive director, Stephanie Proust, she indicated that it would be a good chance for us to do our outreach into the community. So I truly believe that education is the precondition to change. And that's what the exhibit does. And like Kendall said, and like Ramona also indicated, you do learn the story behind the story, because we've all heard bits and pieces of it. Even though I lived it, at that time, I didn't know the theory behind
right.
it.
Right.
So I have learned so much myself.
Well, Bob Retta, stay with us. Bob Retta Bruton is a member of the Community Advisory Board for this exhibit. Kendall Larson is also here, Director of Research and Planning at the Polk County Housing Trust. And we have people who want to join our conversation. You're welcome to join at 866-780-9100. And Maeve is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Maeve.
Hi, Charity.
Hi. What would you like to share?
So the house next door to mine was going to be for sale, or was for sale, and I have a shared driveway. So a friend of mine who's an attorney looked at my abstract to see if there was anything written in the abstract about the shared drive, and there wasn't, but there was a clause written, this is 1924, that no person of color could purchase the house, which floored me. I live in Longfellow neighborhood in Iowa City, and it just seemed, you know, unbelievable that that was written into my abstract. And then even more interestingly, in 1932, the clause was gone. So, you know, people think of Iowa City as being a very welcoming place, but in 1924, it wasn't.
Well, that's such an important story to share. Maeve, thank you so much for calling. And Kendall, I think that that brings up a really important point, because, of course, your work focuses on redlining in Des Moines. We know that there was a map that also redlined neighborhoods in Waterloo, but Iowa didn't have a lot of large cities. That doesn't mean that these policies didn't affect how all of our towns grew, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, there was an underwriting manual, actually, that the federal government put into play along with the redlining maps. And so it was used across the nation for small towns that did not get a map. And so these policies were put into that underwriting manual for lenders and policymakers and city officials to use to put these policies into play into smaller towns as well.
So even if a town wasn't officially redlined, these policies would affect the people who lived there. And
exactly.
As we were talking about earlier, you know, there are so many stories about communities. When we look at slum clearance, we look at urban renewal, things like that. Often the stories start in the 1960s. The story of redlining starts in the 1930s. But in your exhibit, you've decided to go back much further. How far back do you go?
Yeah, so the exhibit actually on our timeline, the exhibit starts in 1800. And it really talks about looking at the Native American removal acts that were put into place and other policies, other exclusionary acts against Asian Americans as well, looking at the end of the Civil War, the Emancipation Proclamation, and thinking about also going into the Great Migration of freed slaves and African Americans moving from south to north. And so we really start back because this, all of the terms, the racial terms that we think about, a lot of it comes from eugenics, which was talked about and really brought forth when the KKK was really strong in the United States back in the late 1800s. And so that's kind of the starting point, really, of what then gets put into federal policy and, you know, in having Jim Crow laws be in the federal government and having racism and racial policies really put into play at that time.
Well, and at that time, but by demonstrating those policies, by showing people that racism was blatantly the reason behind these policies, is it your purpose to really demonstrate how systemic racism is in how our country was built?
Yes, yes. And it also then continues on that timeline to really show that even up to present day, these systems still exist, and the legacies of these past policies and the overt racist policies put into play by the government, even though we have the Fair Housing Act from 1968 to mitigate those issues, but they still last and they still continue to impact how communities grow and grow throughout the nation.
Chris is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I also like to say, let's not forget about Sioux City. Sioux City was is another spot that it was going on crazy back in the day. And the sad fact is, this is still a practice that's still being continued. And so maybe also there's maybe somebody that you guys can have to come on to talk about how to rectify this problem. And then this is the only, you know, it comes with loans and it's an array of different things. It's so much, it's just hard to just try to say everything in one little shot real quick, because it's a bigger picture than what people would think that it is. And then we have the kind of president and the folks at the federal level and state level, and if we're not dealing, we really don't deal with racism. We just want to act like it doesn't exist, but it exists in a big way, especially now when you have
Chris, thank you for making your point. And, you know, Chris brought up Sioux City again, as we mentioned earlier, just because a city wasn't large enough to have one of these maps, it doesn't mean that these policies weren't in place in that city. And Kendall, in thinking about how these policies continue today and continued after they were outlawed, we were talking about that a little bit earlier, that, you know, just because these policies are now illegal and not part of federal policy, it doesn't mean that they're gone, right?
Right, yeah. So a lot of these practices, especially in lending practices, you know, they're so embedded in how the system works, and really how our cities look at the physical level because of these policies that were put into play in the 1930s. And so, yeah, that legacy just continues in these practices, even though they're not overt racist practices today because that's illegal. But a lot, the same system still exists because, as Brayden mentioned earlier, this has never been undone. No one has ever said we need to undo this. And so it's just continued over time in different ways and kind of behind closed doors. And sometimes it's not, people aren't meaning to do it, but it's just so embedded in how our system and how our cities work that it just continues to happen unless we have something like this exhibit and this knowledge to give to our communities and to then think about going forward about how do we take this information, this history, and these stories of people who've experienced this. How do we then, you know, start talking to city officials? How do we start talking to planners of cities and think about how do we start to mitigate these the legacy of these issues? And yes, it's a very, very hard thing to tackle because it is so, there's so many different issues and items that play into this. And because it's been here for a very long time, for decades, it's not just going to happen automatically with one policy to take place or whatever ends up happening. But at least we're starting to have those conversations, which I think is a large part of why this exhibit is so important.
And what do you want somebody to walk out of that exhibit with? I mean, obviously, this is a part of our history that a lot of us aren't familiar with. We're going to learn a lot from the exhibit. But what do you want people to walk away with?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing, and a lot, everybody who's been on here today has really said this, but because it is a community engagement tool, and it's a history, as you said, that's not widespread or common knowledge across the city especially, that it's really important that when you go through the exhibit to be engaged and to really have an open mind, you know, that's what's really important. And to come out with just having this knowledge, to have an understanding that there's something in Des Moines that happened everywhere else and we need to know that it happened here, and to really start to just think about it critically and to think about how it's impacted our city, and to then start to have conversations. I believe that, you know, education leads to action. So
Kendall,
if more people...
Thank you so much for being here today. Kendall Larson of the Polk County Housing Trust and Roberta Bruton, thank you. The exhibit, Undesign the Red Line, is on display at Franklin Junior High through April 18th. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.